Evening, good evening. I want to turn to 1 Corinthians. We will be continuing our study of 1 Corinthians tonight. We'll begin with chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. We just talked in chapters 4 and 5 a little bit about judging, and here in chapter 6 there's some more of the concept about judging. Of course, we talked about the fact that we don't judge people's hearts, that we can't judge their motives and intents, that we don't know what they were thinking when something happened other than what they tell us. But we can judge actions, and we saw in chapter 5 that Paul did just that. But now he's going to move on to a different area of judging. You know, when we think about judging, there are two different types of judging. There is judging that deals with just seeing the facts and making a decision about the facts. And then there's another level of judging that goes beyond the facts. It goes to more of, well, this person says this and this person says that, and who's right and who's wrong. And sometimes that goes beyond facts. There aren't always clear-cut facts to go by. There isn't always a videotape that shows the events just as they occurred that we can look at and say that that's the case. But, you know, we have that in the church all the time. There are often conflicts between this brother and this brother, or this sister and this sister, or this sister and this brother, for that matter, over something where there's a disagreement, and who's going to make the decision about that? Who's going to decide? Sometimes it's something that may not even have anything to do with the doctrine of the church. It may just be a personal matter. Or it may be a situation where one is accusing another of some sin or another. But notice verse 5 and 6 of 1 Corinthians chapter 6. He says, I speak to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brethren. But brother goes to law with brother, and that before the unbelievers. Paul says, it's shameful what's going on in your church. You've got this brother over here suing that one over there and taking him to court. And he asks the question, is there not anybody smart enough, anybody wise enough in your whole congregation to make a decision and make a judgment about who's right and who's wrong in this case? Make that determination without that person having to go to court against his brother? It's a sad situation, isn't it? And he points out then that here, wouldn't you much rather have the judgment come from somebody who's a believer? He says, you're taking it to the law, a brother against a brother, and letting an unbeliever judge it. And particularly if we're talking about the difference between right and wrong, now certainly there are details of law that most of us probably don't understand at all. We're not lawyers. But at the same time, when it comes to right and wrong, we don't have to know the law to know what's right and what's wrong. Many times the law clouds the issue of right and wrong because the law allows things that are wrong to go by and punishes sometimes things that are right. So we have to be careful about that. But there we see this kind of a situation going on in the church in Corinth where these people, they didn't trust anyone else in the church to make a decision, and yet they would go to someone who wasn't even a Christian and let them make a determination in those things. In fact, he goes on in verse 7 to say that it would be better to just suffer the wrong. It'd be better. If somebody stole money from me and I couldn't get it straightened out between me and him or between the church, among the church members, it'd be better if you just suffer the loss than to take it to court and bring shame on the church by doing that. He says, why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? Yeah, you do wrong and defraud your brethren, verse 8 says. And in verse 11, he has just listed a list of some sinful, evil things that are going on in the world, and he says to the Corinthians, and such were some of you. But you are washed, You're sanctified, but you're justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of our God. Again, in this verse, we've already mentioned last week the idea of being sanctified. If there's anybody that ought to be sanctified, it's Christians. And we sometimes shy away from the use of certain words because the denominational world or one particular denominational group of some sort uses that terminology. We don't need to be ashamed to use the terms that the Bible uses. We don't need to be afraid to stand up and say, well, you know what, they may say they're sanctified, but we are sanctified. We know we're sanctified. We're justified by the name of the Lord Jesus. We've been washed, and we know who we are, that we are the children of God. We shouldn't be ashamed to be able to say that. And yet many times we shy away from it because of what goes on out there in the world. But notice what he says about these people. These people, they weren't good, moral, upstanding people who were converted to Christ. These were some wicked people. Look at that list back there in verses 9 and 10. Fornicators and idolaters, adulterers, nor effeminate, that's homosexuals of male homosexuals who allow themselves to be used, and nor abusers of themselves with mankind, that's another homosexual activity being described there, thieves, covetous, drunkards, revilers, extortioners. He made that list and he says, that's what some of you guys were. You see, Jesus is able to cleanse even the most wicked of people and to turn their lives around. He has that power. Of course, they have to be willing to allow him to do that. He will not do so against their will. But he does have that power if they will allow, as these Corinthians did. Now I'll look to chapter 7. There are a lot of interesting things in chapter 7, but I wanted to just focus on two verses toward the beginning. First, verse 2. It says, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. That's one of the reasons. There are other reasons as well for the marriage relationship, but that's one of the reasons that Paul states here for having a marriage relationship. To avoid fornication, to avoid that sexual temptation that comes when there is no lawful outlet for it, for that sexual desire. That's the reason for marriage. That's the purpose that it serves, is to allow a lawful expression of those human desires. Notice verse 4. If husbands and wives could grasp the concepts in verse 4, the stress level in marriage relationships would drop considerably. There'd be so much less stress between the husband and the wife. There are really basically three things that are just major things that husbands and wives fight about. One is money, one is religion, and the other is the physical intimacy. Those are things that husbands and wives fight about a lot. Most marriages break up as a result of one of those three things, or possibly a fourth, and that being in-laws. Those are the four things that if you went and asked all the people that got divorced, they, whatever reason they gave, one of those things would be covered. It'd either be because of money problems, it'd be because of religious problems. Now, religious problems covers any number of, you know, different moral differences that they have. He didn't think it was wrong to go out and sleep around, and she said, I'm not going to put up with that. Well, you've got a moral difference. You've got a religious conflict there, even though they may not either one have actually been very religious in the sense of going to church and that kind of thing. The other is that physical intimacy, that sexual relationship. The conflict over the fact that one is desiring a certain type of intimacy and the other one's not interested, and then the other one wants this other kind of intimacy, and the other one, and you get that conflict all the time. And then, of course, in-laws. When we allow, you know, there's a reason God said that for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother. He doesn't go get his wife and bring her into his parents' house. It doesn't work that way. When it comes time to get married, you leave father and mother and you go make your own home, because that will complicate matters considerably. But notice what verse 4 says. And husbands, I don't want you to be hollering when I get through with the first half of it, because you have to listen to the second half too. The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. And likewise also, the husband hath not power of his body, but the wife. That's a tough one to grasp. That really is. When it comes to that physical, sexual intimacy in the marriage relationship, the idea that the husband has the power over the wife's body, but the wife has the power over the husband's body. You know what that tells me? It tells me that they're both going to have to be agreed before anything that's going to be profitable for both of them can occur. So we need to try our best to understand each other and understand what it is that our spouse wants, or maybe even we could use the word needs, because sometimes it becomes more than just a desire. It actually is a physical need in that relationship in order to keep that relationship going and strong. And so we have to consider that possibility of how we're going to handle those things, and we need to talk about it openly with each other. Don't just think, well, my husband or my wife, she knows how I feel, or he knows what I'm thinking. No, it doesn't work that way. Communication is the key to helping each other understand how we feel about it. And consideration, being considerate, so that we don't force our will on others. And compromise. With this arrangement, that means that sometimes one partner may be interested and the other's not. And this partner gives up their desire and says, okay. Another time, this partner may be interested and this one not, and this one says, okay, I know that you have these needs. And that's part of this cooperation in the marriage relationship where the two become one. I know we've got a lot out here that aren't in marriage relationships, so that may not apply to you, but we've got to preach to everybody, right? Everybody has something in this book for them. Then we come to chapter 8. Chapter 8, we want to look at verse 4. Verse 4 says, as concerning therefore the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is none other God but one. Paul says, we know there's only one God. And those people out there sacrificed their meat to that idol. It doesn't mean a thing to us, because we know that idol is nothing. It's not a God. There's no real significance to that. There's nothing really being done there. There's nothing special, or for that matter, there's nothing bad about that meat because of what those people did with it. They haven't done anything wrong to that meat. And so you've got to understand that in the first century, when you went to the marketplace, particularly in places like Corinth, now you wouldn't have had a problem with this in Jerusalem, but if you were in a place like Corinth or Rome or one of the other major metropolitan cities of the time where the people weren't Christians and they weren't Jewish and they didn't even believe in God, they had all sorts of idols that they worshipped, those people may have sacrificed that meat to their false god, to that idol, and then brought it out to sell. And Paul deals with that very idea that, hey, you go to the marketplace, you buy it, you eat it, don't worry about it. Because whatever they did with offering that to their God, he said, you eat it, you give thanks to the real God for the thing that, you know, for providing this for you, and eat it. Buy it in the marketplace. Don't worry about it. But then he also does say this one more thing. Verse 9. He says, but take heed. In other words, be careful, lest by any means this liberty or freedom of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak. He says, we know there's nothing to that whole idol worship thing, and you go buy that meat and you eat it, and no big deal. But be careful. Don't cause some weaker brother or sister to violate their conscience and to stumble because of your freedom. You see, there are a lot of situations where we may know the truth. And what did Jesus say? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. When we know the truth about things, a lot of times, oh, that sets us free. But there are other people whose consciences are still binding on them, and they would feel so guilty, and they would feel that they had sinned if they did those particular things. So we need to take heed that we don't cause someone else to sin as a result of our freedom. Paul went so far as even to make the point that, hey, if it causes my brother to fall into a sin, I'll never eat meat again. If my eating it is going to cause this brother to sin. Now, as far as we know, Paul never gave up meat, so apparently that never became the situation that someone was caused to sin by him eating meat. As far as we know, he never gave it up. But he had that willingness to do that. See, we've got to understand, in our country, freedom is the biggest, most important thing there is. Everything is about, I have a right, it's my right, I'm free, we are in a free country, I can do what I want. But you know what? The Bible teaches us that our freedom ends when it causes somebody else a problem. We don't always understand that in our country. We've gotten so wrapped up in this freedom that we almost worship freedom. I tell you, they didn't have the freedom that we have back then, but they could still be good Christians. Freedom's a wonderful thing, and I love freedom. And I wouldn't trade it for communism or a dictatorship or some of those other governments that there are in the world. The government we live under, the freedoms that we have, it's wonderful. But we need to remember that those are blessings that we've been blessed with, and we need not to abuse that freedom to the point of harming somebody else. Don and I were talking about this last night. Our freedom ends where the other person's rights begin. That's sometimes a difficult thing for us, because we want ours, mine, me. And that's a lot of times all we're concerned about in our society. But as Christians, the Bible teaches us to think of others as better than ourselves. So we think about them first instead of thinking about me first. And when we do that, you know what's going to happen? Boy, people are going to find out that we're so much easier to get along with. And we're going to find out that other people are so much easier to get along with. When we're not always thinking about me, 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 but we're thinking about that other person's rights, that other person's feelings, not wanting to cause them any injury or any harm, they're going to feel better toward us. We're going to feel better toward them. It's going to make things a lot better. Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Would you like somebody else to use their freedom as a means to just walk all over you? No, certainly you wouldn't want them to do that to you. Well, why would you do it to somebody else? And that's the point Paul makes. Take heed lest this freedom that you have becomes a stumbling block to those that are weak. Don't abuse our rights and freedoms. Because with freedom comes responsibility. We have to accept responsibility for our actions and those that are harmed or helped by those actions. Chapter 9, verse 14. Y'all might think I put this one in here for selfish reasons, but I do think it is a significant verse. Paul says, even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. In other words, it's okay for somebody to make a living preaching the gospel. Now, there certainly is a danger to the individual that's doing that. And that danger is that he may be afraid to tell the truth for fear of losing his income. And I've known some preachers that got themselves into that situation. There are many preachers in denominational groups even who know the truth, but they won't preach it and they won't leave what they're doing to do what's right because they don't want to lose the income. And there are preachers in the church that do that same thing too. They found themselves in a large church and they're making a good bit of money, pulling in a large paycheck, and so they just don't preach against certain sins, against certain wrongs. Now you got the fellow that runs the casino sitting in your congregation. Well, you don't preach against gambling. You know, he gives a lot of money, pays my check. You got the fellow that owns the local liquor store sitting in your car. Well, you don't preach against drinking then, because he pays my check. And there are places that that goes on. One of the big contributors is sleeping around and cheating on his wife. Don't say anything about fornication or adultery or anything. We don't want to offend him and make him leave the church. He gives half the money. That's not right. But that is the danger that comes with it. But even with that danger, the Lord said it's okay for a man to preach the gospel and make his living doing that. Then verse 16, Paul tells the other side of that preaching the gospel that's perhaps the harder part. He says, "For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel." Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, and I won't begin to try to look into the Greek of that verse, but I see two possibilities for the way that verse could read. First of all, woe is unto me if what I'm preaching is not the gospel, if I preach not the gospel. In other words, if I preach some false doctrine. Woe is unto me, certainly, if that's the case. But the second possibility there is as well, woe unto me if I preach not the gospel. Jeremiah talked about the words of the Lord being like fire in his bones. He couldn't even begin to shut it up. He decided at one point, he said, "I'm just not going to talk about it anymore." And he said it just ate away from the inside. See, that's the way for most preachers that I've talked to, that's the way they feel about it. They can't do anything else. They just have to get out there and preach the gospel. But either way, and maybe both ways, you know, sometimes the Bible says something that could be taken two ways and it means them both. Maybe he meant both. Maybe he meant, woe is unto me if I preach something other than the gospel, and maybe he meant, woe unto me if I don't preach the gospel. Either way, it's still very true, certainly with other verses in the Scriptures. Then verse 24. This is something for all of us. "Know ye not that they which run a race all run?" Well, sure, they all run if they run a race. We know that. "But," he says, "one receives the prize." You know, these marathons or sprints in the Olympics, the races, whatever race it is, everybody, you know, the Boston Marathon or New York Marathon, thousands of people out there, you know what? Only one of them wins. Paul says, "So run that you may obtain." Now, we're fortunate in the Christian race, but wouldn't it be a shame if of all the Christians that ever lived, only one got the prize? That would, you know, we may be out of luck. Maybe it's already been won. That's certainly what some religious groups believe, that there's only going to be a certain number given away, and they've already been given away. So the rest of us just get consolation prizes. But fortunately for us, the Christian race is a different kind of race. Because we're not running against each other, we're running against the devil. And as long as we beat him, we win. So we don't have to beat each other. We don't want to beat each other. In fact, we want to help each other along the race. The story is told at the Special Olympics. You know, the Special Olympics is for those who are handicapped either mentally or physically in some way. And they run the races, and they said, there was one race where several of the young people or older people, I don't know what age they all were, but they were running the race, and they were several of them with Down syndrome running this particular race. And as they got to about the halfway mark, one of them stumbled and fell down. And the others ran on a little ways, and then they all noticed that their friend had fallen down. And they went back and helped him up, and then they all went on to the finish line and crossed the finish line together. I think that describes more accurately the Christian race. See, if one of us falls down, we don't just go on and win the race and forget about them. We go back and try to help them. Help them up and help them cross the finish line too. That's the way it's supposed to be in the Christian race. But many times we're too busy to be concerned with our fellow Christians and what can help them to win the race. Chapter 10. There's a rather long section here, but it encompasses a single idea. This is kind of a warning from the history of the children of Israel, from the time they were in the wilderness. We want to start in verse 6. Now these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happen to them for example, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. There has no temptation overtaken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. There's a lot in this verse, but it all boils down to this simple thought. We saw what happened to them, so we shouldn't make the same mistakes. We saw it. We read about it. We know what they did and what happened to them because of what they did. So why would we do the same thing? And yet, despite that, we still murmur and complain. We still follow after worldly things. We're covetous, which Paul tells us that covetousness is idolatry. We lust after the evil things. Sometimes there are those among our number who commit fornication, and we tempt Christ left and right. Did we not learn anything from them? What are we thinking? What are we doing? And Paul tells us, it's not because you can't do any better, because he tells us, there's no temptation that's overtaken you but what's common to man, and God provides a way of escape with every temptation. So we can't say, well, the devil made me do it. No, the devil may have tempted you to do it, but you did it. You made yourself do it. The devil didn't. Nobody else did. We talk about peer pressure. We were talking about peer pressure in our men's class a little bit, and we talk about peer pressure all the time. What we've got to do is teach our young people how to stand up and be strong enough to do what's right regardless of what other people are doing. Look at Joshua and Caleb. You think Joshua and Caleb weren't there when the children of Israel were worshiping the golden calf? Yeah, they were there. Did they worship the golden calf? No. You think they weren't there when the people murmured and complained? Is there any record of them murmuring and complaining? No. You think they weren't there when they had the chance to cross over the Jordan River, but they tempted God by saying, oh, we can't do it, it's too hard. Oh, they were there, and we know what they said then. They said, we can do it. God said we can do it. We need to raise up a generation of Joshua's and Caleb's, and Joshua's wives and Caleb's wives. As far as we know, their wives and families were faithful as well. We need to raise up some young people who are willing to look at the whole rest of the world doing the wrong thing and say, I don't care. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do what God wants me to do. And that's hard. I've been there, and it hadn't been that long ago. I haven't forgotten. It's hard to want to say no when all the people you like and all the people that are popular and everybody else is doing these things. It's hard. But we've got to teach our children that there is something more important than being liked. There's something more important than being rich. There's something more important than being famous. There's something more important than getting a good paying job. Now, we don't want to admit that. We say, oh, I want my child to grow up and get a good paying job and be an upstanding citizen of the community. There's something more important than that. Because sometimes those people that have those good paying jobs are asked to do things that are immoral in order to keep those good paying jobs. We need to teach our children that there are things that are more important than any of that. More important than the kind of car we drive or the house we live in. And yet, still, verse 12, wherefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Sometimes we look back there at those people in the wilderness and we say, I can't believe those people. Look at all the miracles. They saw the Red Sea part and they saw the manna come out of nowhere and they saw the water come out of the rock and they saw all those miracles. I can't believe they were... And we look at the apostles and we say, well, look, Jesus was right there with them, and I can't believe they didn't understand and they didn't know and they did these things and Peter denied Christ and Judas betrayed him. How could they? And we're doing the same things. We need not think that way and be all high and mighty as though, well, we're just great and we don't know. If we'd have been back there, we'd have probably been just like some of those people. We would have said all the same dumb things that Peter said that we laugh about, or we would have been just like Thomas saying, well, I'm not going to believe until I can touch him and stick my hand in his side and stick my finger in his hand where the nails were. I said, I'm not going to believe it, that he's really risen from the dead. Some of us would have been this very same. We need to take heed. We think we stand. We think we're so good and so high above all those. Because the Proverbs tells us, pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before the fall. Sure happened to Alabama yesterday. Their football team going up to play Auburn and they said, we're ranked, Auburn's not ranked, we've won so many games, and we're going to whoop them, we're playing on our home field, nothing can happen to us. See, pride in anything in life, whether it be the Christian life or whether it be a sporting event. You know, I imagine those of you who can cook, if you get all prideful and think you can cook just anything, well, I can, and go in there and your cake might fall. Just when you thought you were so good at it, or you sew in a dress and you're like, boy, I can do this with my eyes closed, and then you get it done and well, this thing doesn't fit right. There's something wrong here. I got an extra hole somewhere or something. You know, that kind of pride will get you every time. Take heed. Be careful. Always watch. We've got to remember that even though we're standing on the solid rock of Christ and the rock of His Word, the devil likes to throw some water on that rock. And you know, rocks get slippery sometimes when they're wet. And the devil is always out there trying to get some water out there on that rock so we'll slip and fall off of it. We may be standing on a solid rock. The rock's not going to move. But we better watch our footing. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, perhaps you need to become one. If you are a Christian, but perhaps you haven't been living your life as you should, you haven't been living up to that sanctified, justified washing that you had, then perhaps you too may need to respond as we stand and as we sing.